This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Hi, how's it going? On the report today, energy from the wind and energy from the Earth's heat. First, we'll look at how small local governments deal with siting wind turbine farms, and then a trip to Iceland and back to the U.S. to look at two different kinds of geothermal methods. And a teenager builds his own electric vehicle to prove a point to the big automakers.
If a kid can build an electric car, why isn't GM doing it? You know, I mean, they can do it. They're just not.
But first, here are some of the stories we're following. Environmental groups are trying to force the federal government to put polar bears on the endangered species list. Mark Brush reports the group not only wants to protect the bears, but they also want to make sure the government does something about global warming.
Scientists say two-thirds of the overall polar bear population could be lost in about 40 years. That's because their home, the Arctic sea ice, is melting. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was supposed to make a decision about putting the polar bear on the endangered species list, but it missed the deadline. So three environmental groups say they'll sue the government. Andrew Wetchler is with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says putting the polar bear on the endangered species list is an important first step.
It will protect it first from global warming itself by requiring the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to prepare a recovery plan and requiring federal agencies, before they issue permits that will exacerbate global warming, to mitigate their impacts.
The listing could become a powerful legal tool. Once the polar bear is on the list, any industry the government regulates that produces greenhouse gases might be affected. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
Speaking of endangered species, environmentalists have found a new way to get people thinking about endangered species through their cell phones. Kyle Norris has the lowdown on that.
That's Mother Nature calling on the other line. It's the howl of a Mexican wolf, and it's part of a collection of endangered species ringtones. The sounds of frogs, birds, and other animals can be downloaded online. The Center for Biological Diversity provides the ringtones free of charge. Peter Galvin is with the center. He came up with the idea because he wanted to connect with a younger, more tech-savvy audience and to get them talking about endangered species.
You're riding in a subway and all of a sudden, you know, you hear this sound and a conversation starts. Someone asks you a question. What the heck is that?
He says people should care about endangered species because the health of the animal world is connected to the health of the human world. For the Environment Report, I'm Kyle Norris.
You know, on the Environment Report, we've looked at what we've sometimes called the boondoggle of using corn for ethanol, because there's so little gain in energy and so many consequences to the environment and food supplies in using grain for fuel. Now, researchers have found using grass instead of corn might be a better way to make ethanol. Rebecca Williams reports.
Ethanol is showing up in more gas stations around the country. Right now, that ethanol is made from corn. But critics say corn ethanol takes a lot of energy to produce, so there's not a huge energy gain from making it. Ethanol made from grass might be a better bet. New research finds that making ethanol from switchgrass is much more efficient than making it from corn. The study's published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In the study, researchers got almost 5.5 times more energy out of the switchgrass than it took to grow, harvest, and turn it into fuel. They say that's a lot better than corn. But there's one big obstacle. The technology to make ethanol from switchgrass on a commercial scale is still being developed. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Another state is getting closer to signing the Great Lakes Compact. That's an agreement which limits water diversions out of the Great Lakes. Marianne Holland reports.
Supporters say the Great Lakes Compact keeps water use decisions in the hands of surrounding states and out of the hands of the federal government. The compact was prompted by attempts to export Great Lakes water. Indiana State Senator Karen Tallien co-authored the bill required for her state to join the compact.
Compacts generally are considered to have an advantage over federal legislation because the states can set up their own agreement, set up their own terms, and once Congress approves it, Congress can't mess with it.
Two states, Illinois and Minnesota, have already joined the compact. Michigan, New York, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, along with Indiana, all have legislation pending. All 8 Great Lakes states have to approve the compact before it goes to Congress. For the Environment Report, I'm Marianne Holland.
While we're on the Great Lakes, a national survey of anglers is trying to determine why fewer people are fishing the Great Lakes. Peter Payette takes a look at that.
The Great Lakes have seen a steep decline in sport fishing in recent years, but Rob Southwick says there's little or no research to explain why. His firm, Southwick Associates, conducts a national survey every month on recreational fishing. In December, they asked anglers about the Great Lakes. Southwick says despite advisories about contamination in fish in the lakes, less than 1% of those surveyed mentioned health warnings as the problem.
We think that was a major issue back in the late 80s and the early 90s, but people are not telling us that's a reason why they're staying away from the Great Lakes anymore.
Southwick says people are finding other lakes and streams to fish, even though no one is complaining about the quality of the fishing on the big lakes. He thinks the time and gear needed to fish the deep, wide waters of the Great Lakes are part of the problem. For the Environment Report, I'm Peter Payette.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up later, we'll drop in on Iceland to hear about how that island nation is using geothermal energy and how we can tap into our own geothermal energy a lot more easily than was once thought. But first, America's hunger for new, greener sources of electricity and a generous federal tax credit are fueling a wind power boom. According to the industry, almost 6,000 megawatts of new wind energy are under construction nationwide. That's 40% of all existing wind power in the U.S., so it's growing fast. The federal government doesn't regulate many aspects of wind power, neither do many of the states. That puts a lot of pressure on local town councils to decide if a wind farm will be a good neighbor. David Summerstein reports.
It's 7:30 in the morning on a crystal clear day in northern New York State. A dozen iron workers huddled between two monstrous red cranes and one gleaming white tower rising 22 stories tall.
Everybody knows their task. Anybody got any questions? We got a beautiful day to fly this thing, no wind.
Today the crew is going to lift the thing you see spinning on a wind turbine. Three blades, each twice the length of semi-trucks, to the top of the tower and attach it. Dave Talley is the supervisor. He's from Petersburg, Tennessee.
I live 20 miles from Jack Daniel's distillery.
Talley's helped build some of the wonders of the modern world. The monorail at Disney World, the world's largest furnace, the largest stamping press.
Yeah, we got a saying in our business, my work is my play is my work. I work harder than I play, and I play hard. If it ain't hard, I ain't playing. Ain't fun, I ain't saying. That's all I'm saying. Crane 2.
The higher you get, the closer you get.
The cranes ease the blades into the air. Talley's crew will do this 122 times to erect Noble Environmental Power's wind farm here. Noble's owned by J.P. Morgan Partners. The company spent millions of dollars and years of permitting and negotiating to get to this point. The wind farm touched off a fiery debate in town. Local board meetings erupted in yelling. Neighbors and families became estranged.
I think there's a lot of people who have family members who completely fight over it. I mean, my sister and I don't. We just don't discuss it.
Julie Rebot can see the turbines from her porch. Her sister works for the wind power company. Rebot, however, is dead set against them.
I don't want to live here.
Really?
I mean, there's 27 supposed to be going up across the street alone.
Yeah.
I don't want, you know, somebody said, oh, it's just like a ceiling fan. Well, would you want 27 ceiling fans going off in your living room? No.
Just next door to Rebot, Richard Wadalski thinks they're great.
We do have to find an alternate source of energy. The price of oil and everything, it's just getting ridiculous. I was told it'll put up 1.5 megawatts of power, which will, supply power for quite a few homes.
Wind developers pay landowners thousands of dollars a year for hosting turbines on their land. But neighbors have to live with the windmills, too, and they don't get paid. Planner John Tenbush says money pits haves against have-nots in a small town.
One guy's going to get a lot of money, and the guy right next door who's going to suffer from the noise or the blinking effect or some other adverse impacts gets nothing.
Across the country, industrial-scale wind projects are forcing small, mostly rural town councils to make big decisions. The federal government and most states offer little guidance on a blizzard of complicated issues. How far should the turbines be from a house or road? How loud can they be? Do they boost or blemish property values? Do they kill too many birds? David Duff is on the planning board in nearby St. Lawrence County. He says it's easy for town councils to get in over their heads.
Maybe they buy snowplows and maybe they put out contracts for salt. They are not in the same league in terms of negotiating with a multinational company. Who's done this before?
Until regulation catches up, the burden falls on local town councils when wind power moves in. For the Environment Report, I'm David Summerstein.
This is the Environment Report. In just a bit, we're going to hear about a teenager who converted a pickup truck from a gasoline engine to an electric-powered vehicle, a 16-year-old. But right now, you might be hearing about geothermal energy more and more. But what exactly is geothermal energy? Well, the new Federal Energy Act calls for more research and investment into that alternative energy source. Robbie Harris has more on this long-used but little-known technology for tapping the Earth's heat.
In Iceland, where geysers gush from the ground and steam rises from the bays, geothermal is the number one source of energy. This island nation in the North Atlantic burns virtually no fossil fuel.
You will probably not see a single building that's not heated by geothermal energy.
Palt Valdemarsson is director of research and development with Enix. It's Iceland's largest geothermal consulting firm. Steam blasts from hot water wells at Iceland's newest state-of-the-art geothermal plant. The steam spins turbines to make electricity. The superheated water is piped directly into buildings where it gives up its heat. Few places have the hot water resources Iceland has, but according to the Geothermal Resource Council, superheated water is available virtually anywhere in the world, if you drill deep enough. The U.S. already taps this underground hot water to produce more geothermal electricity than Iceland does. But for decades, Americans have also used a different form of geothermal energy to heat and cool buildings. Eric Larson is a vice president of Indy Energy. He calls it the other geothermal, which is basically
free heat from the earth in the wintertime in an extremely efficient way to reject heat from the building in the summertime.
Larson says geothermal or geoexchange systems are comparable to traditional heating, ventilation, and cooling systems, but they use the Earth's constant underground temperature, around 55 degrees in most of the U.S., to take the edge off a building's heating and cooling load.
Geothermal heat pump technology, like we're talking about, can be done anywhere in the country. We can put in our series of closed-loop wells and exchange heat with the Earth to provide an HVAC system.
For a long time, in rural areas, large horizontal loops, several feet underground, captured and released heat. But in urban areas, there wasn't enough land. Now Larson says Indy Energy uses a new drilling technique known as a vertical closed loop system. He says they can be installed under almost any building. Pipes inside wells hold a fluid, which continuously circulates between the ground and the building, creating a heat exchange. Larson says a geothermal system saves owners money.
We are a system that you would fully own from sort of the generation or the ground loops, these wells that we put in, through the distribution, which is basically happening within your building. And you take advantage of all the savings.
Larson says geothermal systems for buildings cost anywhere from 50 to 100% more than a typical system. But he says most pay for themselves in 5 to 8 years with the energy savings. Business is booming. 4 months ago, they installed a large geothermal system at Buku Community Center in Evanston, Illinois. They helped train new workers in geothermal technology. It was a joint project between Indy Energy and Buku. They're training workers for a new green industry they hope will not only save resources, but create new jobs. For the Environment Report, I'm Robbie Harris.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. People have been talking about electric cars ever since cars first hit the road, but nobody has mass-produced an electric car, or at least they're not doing it right now. General Motors says it's working on a gas-saving electric vehicle that could be ready in 2010, but some people aren't waiting around. Dustin Dwyer recently met someone who converted his pickup to run on batteries.
You don't have to be a mechanical expert to build an electric car. I recently caught up with a 16-year-old who did it on his own.
I'm Andrew Angelotti. I converted a Mazda pickup truck to electric power, run off of batteries.
Angelotti's pickup has 20 batteries in all. Four of them are tucked under the hood of the red Mazda B2200. There's another 16 batteries in the bed of the truck. Angelotti says these are basically golf cart batteries. He charges them through a cord that runs from his garage and plugs into the front grille of the truck.
Is it drivable now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Could we take a ride?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
We jump into the truck, and here things are a bit weird. Pretty much all the knobs and vents have been ripped out. Angelotti says this is because the heating system was all hooked up to the gas engine, so he had to get rid of it. That means he has no heat. But basically, this truck works just like your vehicle. Angelotti puts the key in the ignition, and he turns it.
That's the vacuum pump running for the power brakes. That's my radio.
Once he gets it up to speed, the electric pickup drives and rattles the same as any other old pickup on the road. Angelotti says he decided to start this project one night when he was looking around at stuff on the internet.
I saw this site about electric vehicle conversions, and as I was looking at it, I saw how practical it actually is, you know, and how it's not that complicated and it's actually not that expensive when you put it in perspective. And I decided I wanted my first car to be an electric car.
The conversion process took 9 months, and it cost about $6,000. Angelotti paid for it himself with money he made as a lifeguard. He says the work on the truck wasn't always easy.
There were quite a few points during the project, you know, kind of a hard part, you know. I'd start thinking, you know, for $6,000 I could have a really cool car. But, you know, I woke up the next morning and I'm like, but nobody else is going to have an electric car. So I decided to keep going with it.
And this past summer, several months after Angelotti's 16th birthday, the truck was finished. He splashed neon green lettering on the side to let everyone know it's an electric vehicle. And he says now the truck draws a crowd wherever it goes. Angelotti says that's kind of the point, to raise awareness and let people know that there is a more sustainable way to drive. He drives me a couple of miles near his house, which is about an hour north of Detroit. And when we get back, Angelotti plugs the truck back in. He says he can get 40 miles between each charge. That's 40 miles with no gas. And he's doing it right now. Automakers say they won't have any kind of electric vehicle until 2010 at the earliest. So I asked Angelotti, if a teenager can build an electric car in his mom's garage, why can't the big automakers like GM do it?
GM can build an electric car. In fact, are you familiar with the EV1?
Yeah.
Well, they can do it. And that's a large part of the message I'm trying to send is, if a kid can build an electric car, why isn't GM doing it? You know what I mean? They can do it. They're just not.
Of course, it's not really that simple. Angelotti's truck is not the kind of solution that would work for everyone. He's making some big sacrifices to drive his electric truck. He spent more money on the truck to begin with. And remember, he's got no heater. It takes 10 hours to get the truck fully juiced. Its top speed is 55 miles per hour. Angelotti can never take it more than 40 miles from home without recharging. And in 3 to 5 years, he'll have to shell out more money to replace his batteries. So really, how many of us would be willing to make those sacrifices? As for Angelotti, he says the sacrifices he's making are worth it. And he's already started working to convert his second electric car. For the Environment Report, I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Speaking of Detroit automakers, the executive chairman of Ford Motor Company, Bill Ford, gave a lecture on sustainability not all that long ago. He talked about Ford spending $23 billion on research and development on things such as clean diesel, lighter vehicles, more gas-electric hybrids, new, more efficient transmissions, and engines. Well, we were at that lecture, and we have an excerpt of how Bill Ford sees the future of his company.
There are no shortcuts to sustainability. However, there are a number of paths that are promising, and Ford is exploring them with a real sense of urgency. The cornerstone of our near-term environmental strategy is going to be a new family of engines with gasoline turbo direct injection, which both boosts power significantly and also substantially reduces fuel consumption. In the next few years, we expect to introduce these engines in a number of products across North America. We've also committed to doubling the number of our flexible fuel vehicles in our lineup by 2010. And if the renewable fuel infrastructure can support them, we stand ready to expand the production of these vehicles by 50% of our total output by the year 2012. In the longer term, our sustainability strategy calls for a higher volume application of hybrid technologies. Getting to where technologies such as plug-in hybrids and fuel cells are affordable in high volumes requires that we prepare today. Right now, we're working on hybrids, plug-in hybrids, hydrogen fuel cells, internal combustion hydrogen, flex fuel vehicles that are on the road and also in laboratories around the world. Last month, I was in California, where we're working with Southern Cal Edison on the plug-in hybrid project, and we're trying to figure out ways with South Cal Edison, how do we commercialize them? And our partnership is going to not only just look at the vehicle, but also the grid, and how do we power our vehicles and also use the vehicles to give power back to the grid. It's a fascinating project and one which I think holds tremendous project. But it was interesting when I was also in California, I spoke with opinion leaders and environmentalists, and they were really surprised to learn all the things that Ford is doing to achieve sustainability. There's this mindset out there that people in Detroit are a bunch of, you know, Neanderthals, and we're not doing anything to promote this agenda. But when I was able to explain to them what we were doing, first they were a little disbelieving, then they were shocked, and then they said, well, you've got to tell people. You've got to tell your story and be much more vocal so that people can understand the depth of your commitment. In August, I met with the Ford team, and this was kind of interesting, that just set the new world speed record in the Ford Fusion powered by a hydrogen fuel cell in the Bonneville Salt Flats. It went more than 200 miles per hour. What was interesting isn't the fact that it could go fast. It's the fact that we could do a completely zero-free vehicle and have it perform like the best sports car out there today. Because one of the things we know is ultimately people don't want trade-offs. People tell us they value environmental benefits, and increasingly that's true. But they don't want trade-offs in performance, cost, or functionality. After 100 years of evolution, the automobile is really on the edge of a revolution. We have the opportunity to radically transform our personal mobility and eliminate the trade-offs that threaten our planet and the future generations that will be living on it. I'm confident that we can do it, and I can't wait to continue on this journey. Thank you very much, and what I'd love to do now is take any questions that's on your mind. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, I'm Lester Graham. I'm with the Environment Report at Michigan Radio. You mentioned flex-fuel vehicles, and you'll correct my numbers. I think you said you have 5 million flex-fuel vehicles on the road right now. Uh-huh. You're increasing production by 50%. With corn ethanol as our main fuel, and that being such a poor energy gain, I think it's 25% by most studies, and no real breakthroughs on cellulosic ethanol, I'm wondering why go ahead with the increase in flex-fuel vehicles?
Well, if you recall, a lot of what I said we announced a year ago. And a year ago, you know, it was part of the State of the Union address. There was going to be a real push on ethanol. In fact, there was. But you hit upon a couple of important points. One is that if it's food-based ethanol, you hit the wall pretty quickly. And the presumption was that we would make great strides in the cellulosic ethanol. And if you get to that point, then it greatly expands the amount of usable material that you have to make ethanol. And so we've been doing it in Brazil. Our cars have been running on ethanol down there for years. There it's sugarcane-based, but obviously here it has been mostly corn-based, and we knew and we do know that long-term, that's not the answer. The other issue, of course, is infrastructure. It's very tough to refuel with ethanol, but frankly, that's true of all the various fuels that we're looking at. Wherever we head as a society, we need to decide as a society where we want to go, because it doesn't do any good if we have the hardware if you can't fuel it up. And that's true whether it's ethanol or whether it's hydrogen or any of the other fuels that we're looking at. And this country can probably stand one major tear-up to its infrastructure. And we need to decide collectively, you know, what road we're going to go down and how we're going to get there. And that's why we need all the parties at the table. We can't solve the infrastructure. All we can do is provide the hardware. That's what we're doing. And if cellulosic comes along, which we don't control, great, we're ready for it. But if it doesn't, then people are going to be driving around in flex fuel vehicles and they'll be filling up with gasoline. So I guess the way I'd like to leave this with you is we're doing our part and we're doing everything we can to push the envelope on these new technologies. But it's bigger than us. And part of it is cost of fuels. If the customer, until recently, and unfortunately, we're at almost $100 barrel oil, but turn back the clock, 18 months, with gasoline cheap, there was no incentive for a customer to come in and buy ethanol unless there was either a tax on gasoline or a big tax break for ethanol. It's got to be in the customer's economic self-interest to buy a certain fuel. Again, we can't control that. So we've got the hardware. We're pushing hard as we can on it, on not just this hardware, but all the others that I talked about. But it does require a comprehensive effort, and we don't have that in this country. And until we get it, we're not going to have the right solution.
That's an edited excerpt of Ford Motor Company Executive Chairman Bill Ford delivering the Peter M. Wege Lecture at the University of Michigan back in November. And that's the Environment Report. Mark Brush is my co-editor. He says scientists think 40% of all of the Arctic ice will melt by the middle of this century, not leaving a lot of room for polar bears. Rebecca Williams is our chief reporter. She's trying to persuade her husband that they need to plant switchgrass in their lawn and harvest it for ethanol. It's a cash crop. There are photos such as polar bears, the 16-year-old who converted his truck to electric power, and some Iceland photos, as well as links for lots more information, all available for you at www.environmentreport.org. And if you want to drop us a line, talk about Ford, GM, or the other auto manufacturers in the future of the car, or about something we should be covering, our email address is feedback@environmentreport.org. The Environment Report is a tiny little division of Michigan Public Media.
Support for the Environment Report podcast comes from the Nature Conservancy, working to protect nature and preserve life worldwide. For Michigan and Great Lakes information, nature.org/Michigan. Support for Environment Report stories comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. Send your comments about the Environment Report to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.